Hello again, this is Jay Namro. You know what? I spend a lot of time being frustrated with people. That they don't see. That they don't see what I see. I don't want to get cocky to say, oh, well, you know, this just indicates my greatness because I can see things that you can't see. I'm not saying that I'm absolutely positive that I've got it all completely straight. But I'm trying. And boy, I hope I'm getting closer. I have faith that I'm getting closer. Because of what I've learned and how it fits with what I've already known and how it changes me and how it makes me a better person. All right, let's talk about godsend here a bit. I started to, and it just started coming up. The whole thing about godsend is examples of people coming up the bat. The scriptures are by and large the same way. They really are, you know, when it's not just talking doctrine. Our family's reading in Leviticus right now. It's just a bunch of, and this is how you do this, and this is how you do that, and this is how you do this. This, you know, it's more of a policy manual for the Levitical priesthood. So it's dry, and there's nothing, and it's not very exciting. Now the stories and the people and how they are and how they behave and what they end up doing. I'm not saying the policy manuals aren't important. It's important to know what God expects you to do. But the inspiring parts, the parts that tell you stories of great people, are just as important. And that is important. Sometimes we get kind of stuck on, like, Paul's letters to this person, to that person. You get into a lot of caveats doing that, because by and large you don't have the information from which those letters were written. You know, there are responses to communications. We're only getting one side of the conversation. We don't know what the other people said. We don't know what prompted Paul to write what he did. And yet we base almost everything in the Christian universe on Paul's letters. Because that's all we have. Besides the Gospels. And the book of Revelations, which is so chock full of imagery that it's really hard to pick out what's really... What you're supposed to think about this stuff. Paul did a great job of helping people in his time come up with what Christ-like living should be. And that's great. That's why we have a lot of people that just by default, because it's just been so drilled into them, that people are good. People tend to be good folk. Take care of each other. Whatever. They tend to be nice people. Now, I've lost the train of thought, so I'm going to go in another direction. There's always been a great need for these stories of great godly people. Sometimes it can get really confusing because, people become very confused. I'm sorry. There was somebody who didn't know where they were going, I think, on the road, and they keep slowing down, getting ready to turn, then they turn their signal lights on. They just weren't making any sense, and I needed to get away from them. I have now. Story of godly people. We just recently got done with Genesis. Genesis is full of really intensely great people. Abraham is one of these. And it's really easy for people to look at these and say, these guys weren't that great. In fact, I can, just looking at the thing, I can see where God is a jerk, where, you know, where Abraham is a dimwit. No, okay, who is the absolute dimwit sometimes? Jacob is mostly a story, no, wasn't Jacob, Isaac. Isaac and Rebecca. You know, that Isaac was this guy who seemed to be having problems doing what God wanted to do. And yet he was this guy that God came and talked to and was this great thing. And it's easy when just looking at the stories that way that you're going, these people weren't that great. They weren't that amazing. But you have to understand, yes, they were. Abraham was an amazing person. He was better than most of us will be. But he was a person. You know? And I think sometimes we really do misconstrue a lot of those things. So I wanted to come out with some things that were clear, give it some time. The fact that I'm doing it with fiction, I hope, isn't too off-putting. There's plenty of examples of real people who do these things. It's hard to come up with them because they're usually so personal. They're usually these are things that these kind of people tend to just go quietly about their business. Abraham was not a flamboyant person, as far as we know. You know, there are stories that came down mostly because children of Israel were children of Israel. They were children of Abraham. So these are more the family history sorts of stories that we've got. And you don't get any impressions that any of these people were particularly, you know, it was like, oh, he was the most famous man in his age. No, he wasn't. Abraham wasn't particularly famous, but the Bible was mostly his family history, not not a history book of the most important things that went on. God typically doesn't really do things with the most important people, because the most important people aren't usually interested in following God. You know, they're kings and people like that who, frankly, don't have much interest in these things. Anyway, that's what I want to do. And if these things tend to shake people up and make them say, oh, God, that's not anything like I expected of God. A lot of people, when they first read about Nephi, and just a stalwart, righteous, just driving righteousness. Pissed off his brothers to no end. Sorry. Forked off his brothers to no end. They hated him. They wanted to kill him. They beat him. They tied him up. They did all kinds of things. Because they wanted to do what they wanted to do, by golly. And Nephi just would not give them any peace at all. Because he'd say, no, you need to repent. You need to stop. You know. And they had seen angels. They had even done all this. But they were still steadfastly doing evil. And they influenced generations through their evil. And Nephi influenced generations through his good. Okay. So that's where we come down to these wonderful stories of amazing people. And they tend to be family stories from the sole reason that our righteousness tends to build on what we were able to do as children. Greater things that come. Not to say that you can't change your life and go from bad to good and be and be great in the sight of God. I'm not saying that that's not possible. But you have to understand, he says, look at the children of Israel, that is a family. Most of the Old Testament that we have is the story of a family. Moses, when he wrote the five books of Moses, we have he was collecting the records of the children of Israel. Israel had a common father. His name was Jacob. It was Israel. That common father, his father was Isaac, and his father before that was Abraham, in whom the covenant was given. Now, we have information from the others, but it's mostly a family tree. It's mostly a thing of, well, this is a descendant of this, this is a descendant of that. And it's really simple. I think that's why when we get to Noah and his children, things just kind of, it isn't that they wander, but all of a sudden you have Abraham. And you go, well, you have to understand, Abraham was a descendant of Noah. And there might not have been very many records about that except to say the genealogy. So that's, as far as I'm aware, that's what the Bible predominantly, the Old Testament predominantly is. We have Ruth, who wasn't a descendant of Israel at all, as far as we're aware of. She might have been, but she definitely wasn't a Jew, and she definitely wasn't one of the children of Israel. She was from another place, but she converted. But otherwise, that's what we have. And that's what the story of God says. If Godsend ends up being, it's the story of this family. It wasn't always that way, but it became that. It was the story of Melisenda's family. Melisenda, who eventually broke away from the evil of her time, married Davor, had Westland, who was one of the great priesthood holders, and one of the only ones. This was a land not with a bunch of priesthood. It wasn't there. And then Westland's and Michiana's daughter, Julia. And how all this stuff happened, how it all came to pass. And that these weren't perfect people. They were trying, but they weren't perfect. And what happened, what was gone through. How things were perceived. And Enos, although he wasn't part of this family, definitely was a symbol, was a person that you could take inspiration from. And the fact that in the first chapter of Godsend, Enos kills people. And you can't say, oh, well, it was war, it was their enemy, yada, yada, yada. No, he was killing his friends. Or people who had been his friends. People that were bound together in a covenant with God. And these people walked away from it and said, we're not going to do this anymore. He could have been kinder under different circumstances. He could have been kinder if they would have chosen to air their grievances at a different time. But they had chosen to make a political statement on, you know, 2 minutes before the battle was to begin. Like the battle was beginning. And then these guys came up and they said, "We've grown weary of this whole thing. We're tired of it. And we're going to go in another direction." And their biggest mistake was they were on the wrong side of the path. Does it create a lot of resentment, a lot of anger? But it really does say, are you loyal to the covenant that you made? Are you loyal to God? Or do you have other concerns? And nobody's saying that the concerns that they said weren't valid, or that under other circumstances they wouldn't have been the overriding thing. But you have to understand, in a covenant situation, if you make a covenant to do something, that's what you need to do. And if it doesn't seem very logical to you, if it doesn't seem very, very right to somebody else who didn't take that covenant, that doesn't matter. The point is that you abandoned your covenant to God, and whatever you were to get from that covenant, or whatever punishment was affixed to it, that's what was done. And that's exactly what it is. There is a covenant affixed to Waykeep, those that are there. If you didn't want to take that covenant, you could leave. You could walk away. Nobody was going to kill you. Nobody was going to do anything. But these were people who had taken upon themselves the covenant. So they're killed, and their families are told, you know, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go? Or no, they didn't really ask them, what are you going to do? They say, are you still loyal to the covenant? And it comes to find out that the teachings of these men were also what their wives believed and what they were teaching their children. Not bad things. Nobody's saying that they were bad things, but they had rejected the covenant. Therefore, they could not stay in Waykeep. And that these people had developed a resentment toward those who they had viewed were getting people killed. You know, I had a son die. I'm tired of all the killing. I'm tired of it all. And you go, okay, then you're going to have to leave. But don't you dare approach the path, because we will keep the covenant. That's what happened to your husband and to your son. They chose not to keep the covenant, so they died the path. They were just like anybody else trying to go through that path. That's what the covenant is. The covenant is that you would protect that path against anyone who had not taken this covenant. And everybody was very animate. If you came here, you couldn't go back the way you had come. You couldn't do it. That's why when Julia and Nickel and Zan, that's what they're presented with. It says, you cross this path, you must either take the covenant upon yourself to be a member of this community, or you can't come back this way. And it didn't matter how loving and kind and wonderful Ennis was, you knew exactly where he stood. And he said, if you try to come back through this way, I will kill you, because that's my covenant. That's the covenant I've made. And so going to Waykeep isn't a simple prospect. You don't just do that. The fact that these are the only people of God, it doesn't mean they're the only people of God. It's the only example of the people of God that we have until Melisandre and Daemor. And it's not to say that the people in Waykeep are better. Some of them are, and it most certainly is. But it's just that they live by that covenant. That's what God has asked them to do. That's what they have promised to do, and they'll do it. And that's exactly what Ennis has to tell these people. And there is no exception. When Julia passes through there, although she thinks Ennis is nigh unto God, although Ennis loves her as a daughter, he knows that her place is not to be among those in Waykeep. But she can't do that. She can't remain there. And he says, you've chosen to step on this line. Because you can never come back this way again. This is a sealed gate. You can pass through the one way, but you cannot pass through the other. And that's almost essentially why those people are there. I'm almost starting to think that that's what it is. That this is a porous barrier one way. You can leave this place, but you can't come back. And that's why when Julia comes back, she has to go through the desert. But that becomes her great trial as to whether she's going to do what God asks or not. And that's important. What is going on? Everybody's pulling over and doing funny things out here, huh? Making me crazy. All right. Well, that's all the thing I have time for. We'll get back to this again. More God said, because I got to help myself get the stuff all done. I'm Jay Nemro, and you're listening to Quasi-Indefatigable Zenilith. Have a great day.